And the Labor, Industry, Veterans, Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is the custom of this committee, we will begin the committee hearing with the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Detmer.
Present.
Yeah. Representative Detmer, present. Representative McDonald.
Present.
Representative McDonald, present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Edelson, present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick, present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston, present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the March 15th, 2022. Deb Detmer, did you get a chance to check out the minutes?
I'm back. Yes, I approve the minutes.
Representative Detmer, who moves the minutes from March 15th, 2022? Any questions, additions, or deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Minutes are adopted. Members, we have two bills on the agenda today. The first is from Representative Davids, House File 4272. I move to refer House File 4272 to the Capital Investment Committee. Welcome back, Representative Davids, to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And this is a very important bill for the three new veteran homes that are currently under construction. If we go back some months here, the Department of Veterans Affairs put out the bids, and because of higher costs, higher material costs, we came up a little short. Now, I just want to give a great deal of gratitude and thanks to the department, because what they basically did to make this work is they got all three homes, the one in Bemidji, Montevideo, and then the one in Preston, they got them going, but they had to dig into their funds, a bit here, to the tune of just over $10 million. So when this happened, I had agreed to work hard to try and get that money back to the department. So what this bill does is it puts $10.329 million from the general fund to the Department of Administration, basically to backfill what the Department of Veterans Affairs had to do to make this work. And they did a wonderful job. I said I would try and help out. That's what this bill does. This makes them whole so that they don't have to reduce their budgets because they did the right thing for the three veterans homes. So in a nutshell, that's the bill, members, and I would really appreciate your support to get this to the next committee.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Any member questions? Well, thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Davids. It's tremendously important that we get these new homes completely funded so that they'll be ready to go when we start up. And I think I'm number two on this bill, if I'm not mistaken. But thank you, Representative Davids. Any final comments?
Members, I'd really appreciate your support on this very important bill for our veterans. And thank you for the hearing, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Mr. Petrie, will you please take the roll on the bill?
Chair Eklund.
Before I do that, I just skipped ahead of my script. I renew my motion that House File 4272 be referred to Capital Investment. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll. Chair Eklund, aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Representative Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Representative Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
Representative McDonald, aye. Mr. Chair, we have 13 ayes and zero nays.
13 ayes and zero nays. Representative Davids, you're on your way to capital investment.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Zhang for the presentation and discussion of House File 4177. Representative Zhang.
All right. Thank you, Chair Eklund. Members, our final bill is from Chair Eklund, House File 4177. Chair Eklund, please move and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4177 be laid over for possible inclusion. Mr. Chair, I'll just go briefly through the articles because we have several testifiers to get into the details. Article 1, Subdivision 2 includes the labor standards apprenticeship program appropriations. Department's request, I think we know from this past couple of years how much of a problem some of our workforce issues have been. So increasing the apprenticeship appropriations is something that definitely needs to be done. Section 2, Subdivision 3 includes $747,000 for youth skills training grants, program administrations. And again, we'll have agency people go into the details, but anything that we can do to help improve our workforce standing is, I applaud the agency for bringing this forward. Section 2, Subdivision 4 includes $150,000 base appropriation for the Office of Combative Sports. They've been falling behind, so we need to help them out. And this portion, I think, is actually going to be pulled out and it's going to be run as a separate bill at some point in time. Section 3 includes $51,000 in funding for management budget related to earned sick and safe time. Article 2 includes policy and technical language for the department's budget proposals. Section 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, and 8 are all technical cleanup to establish a separate division of labor standards and the division of apprenticeship. Section 6 expands the scope of the LEAP grant, and we'll hear more about that from testifiers. Section 9 broadens the CCLD jurisdiction to assisted living facilities. This proposal gives the agency regulatory oversight of assisted living facilities and assisted living with dementia care facilities licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health. Assisted living is the only remaining type of housing in Minnesota serving vulnerable adults that are not under DLI jurisdiction. Section 10 includes commercial energy code improvements. Since 2005, greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15%, partially driven by higher heating and cooling demands caused by a changing climate. This language establishes an adoption of framework for the statewide commercial building energy code that ensures all new commercial and large multifamily construction is net zero by 2036. Section 11 corrects an error from last session that continued fee reduction for licenses, building permits, and plan reviews for 2 years. While the fiscal tracking was correct and reflected the full $4.5 million revenue reduction for fiscal year 22 and 23, last year's billing language only addressed the license fee reductions. Section 11 of this bill provides the extension for lower building permit and plan review fees as was intended by the legislature and DLI, retroactive to October 1, 2021. DLI has continued to assess lower fees as intended. Section 12 of Article 2 adds effective dates for cleanup provisions within the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council bill that passed earlier this session. The prior law passed without effective dates recommended by the council, and without this addition of an effective date, the day following final enactment, provisions won't be in effect until August 1 of 2022. Article 3 is OSHA federal penalty conformity. Minnesota OSHA needs to align the penalties it issues to employers that fail to provide safe and healthy workplaces for their workers with federal OSHA guidelines. This language conforms with federal maximum penalties and ties future penalties to inflation. Penalty conformity would ensure that federal OSHA does not take over jurisdiction in Minnesota. Article 4 is Ag, Food, and Processing Worker Provisions. The propose amendments, update and expand workplace protections for agriculture and food processing workers, so that a greater number of these workers are protected and aware of their workplace rights. The changes amend the migrant labor law, the recruitment food processing employment law, and the packing house workers bill of rights law. Article 5 and 6 are earned sick and safe time. This proposal matches the language in HF 7 and now HF 41, authored by Representative Olson. The changes would ensure workers can accrue up 48 hours a year of earned sick and safe time for when they need to cover for illness, going to a medical appointment, care for a child during a school closure, or get care and assistance due to domestic abuse, stalking, or sexual assault. Article 7 is combative sports. This statutory changes better protect combative health and safety. The agency's Office of Combative Sports regulates professional boxing, professional and amateur mixed martial arts. And in a nutshell, Mr. Chair, that is the bill, and I would turn it over to the testifiers.
All right. Looks like we have the Commissioner Robertson. Please introduce yourself and you may begin.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. You heard from our agency last week when I presented the entirety of the bill. I was invited back to continue the discussion today, and I would like to focus on just a few of the proposals. Mainly, I'm very interested in providing additional detail and discussion, particularly on our workforce development pieces. As Chair Eklund indicated, we know that we have to take this time to reassess and reinvest in our workforce development programs. Labor and industry has a tremendous impact on workforce development through the programs that are administered through our agency. I'll spend my time today talking about equity in apprenticeship, prevailing wage, education and compliance, and YST supplemental budget requests. So I do have a couple of my staff that's with me this afternoon, and if my staff can share the screen. So some of this is a repeat, but I think it bears additional discussion. And last week we were really pressed for time and there was no time for committee engagement or any questions. So today I will slow the tempo down just a little bit and get into some of the details that support these requests. So beginning with Article 1, Section 2, Subdivision 2, I'll start with the labor standards and apprenticeship appropriations. That includes equity in apprenticeship and prevailing wage enforcement. So we'll start with the equity in apprenticeship. This is a good place to start. We continue to hear what a great investment registered apprenticeship is across the state. We know that Minnesota apprentices are some of the most marketable workers really in the nation. We get constant good feedback regarding the effectiveness of the program, and most importantly, registered apprenticeship produces skilled trades persons who are more than capable of producing a family-sustaining wage rate. They produce highly skilled individuals that contribute to our infrastructure day in and day out. So what is this proposal about? This proposal is multi-pronged, beginning with the proposal includes resources to separate the apprenticeship and labor standards unit. The units were combined back in the mid-2000s, actually early 2000, because of concurrent years of severe contraction within the state general fund budget. After many years of contraction, labor and industry was no longer able to sufficiently support the business units as standalone units. So we made the difficult decision to combine the programs, leveraging our resources to really to reduce the administrative costs of both programs. The decision was made in combining these programs that both programs would have a single director of the program. So today, the state director of labor standards is also the state director for registered apprenticeship. Since these units were combined, both programs have begun to recover and in some instances have grown considerably to the point that it no longer makes good business sense to have the units combined. With the growth in registered apprenticeship in particular, it is timely and it's necessary that that business unit have a recognized director that is solely responsible for the apprenticeship activity and to relieve the current director over both programs from the responsibility of registered apprenticeship. The second prong of this request is to make an increased investment in the LEAP funding. LEAP stands for Labor Education Advancement Program. It is a program that was started at the federal level back in the late 60s to ensure that women and people of color had an opportunity to participate in registered apprenticeship programs. The funding was continued at the federal level at a rate of $200,000 per year. At the time that this grant was available at the federal level, the grant was utilized here in Minnesota to help support registered apprenticeship support activities that was undertaken by the then Minneapolis Urban League and separately the St. Paul Urban League. Since that time, the Minneapolis and Urban League programs have combined, so now we have the Twin Cities Urban League. That said, the federal funding continued for a number of years until the early 70s, at which time the Federal Department of Labor sunsetted that grant program. At that time, the Minneapolis and St. Paul Urban Leagues petitioned the Minnesota state legislature to pick up that funding. The Minnesota legislature did, in fact, pick up that funding, and the Minneapolis and St. Paul Urban Leagues continued to utilize the grant funds that were allocated. Then we fast forward a couple of years, and labor and industry received a court decision that this grant fund could no longer be exclusive to the St. Paul and Minneapolis Urban League, and we had to create a competitive program allowing other community-based organizations to compete. We did that, of course. And today we have up to five community-based organizations competing for those grant dollars. Another change that has taken place over time was back in the first Ventura, not the first, the first budget of the Ventura administration sought to eliminate the funding for LEAP grantees. The funding was completely wiped out, and through, again, lobbying efforts, 100,000 of the original 200,000 was reinstated. Now, you're talking about a program that started in the late 60s with $200,000 shared by two, fast forward all the way to the early 90s to up to five groups competing for those same dollars, and then subsequent changes where the amount of funding was cut by 50%. Today, we have a $100,000 appropriation that is that through a competitive process, up to five community-based organizations compete for that. So I trust that everyone probably know where I'm going with this. $200,000 in the late 60s compared to $100,000 today, we know that the buy-in power that was intended with this grant program is no longer realized today. The feedback from our community-based organization partners is the funding of today simply is not capable of producing the intended results. The whole purpose of the program is for community-based organizations to work with the individuals that could benefit from registered apprenticeship by providing them good information, supporting their desire to enter into registered apprenticeship, and helping to provide some of those wraparound services that are absolutely critical when introducing a new program into communities that have not had high participation rate. As we move forward here, what we're looking for is increasing the LEAP grants to $1 million. This will allow more community-based organizations to participate, as well as allowing some of our joint apprenticeship committees to also utilize funds that will help them recruit and retain and support women and people of color and indigenous populations. We know that apprenticeship, the call and the utilization of apprenticeship will only increase in the years to come, particularly because Minnesota is on par to receive up to $7 billion from the Build Back Better program. We know that where apprenticeship is, where there is expansion in the infrastructure, there will be an expansion and utilization of apprentices in working on those projects. And therefore, we believe it's very timely. We have information that shows with working with the community-based organizations that work very closely with their community members is the best way to support this initiative. We're very proud of the work that has been done, but we believe that more work is necessary in order to meet the continued challenges in the workplace. Construction, as many industries, has experienced a great deal of a great decline in the number of individuals that are available to work in that industry. That is partly due to baby boomers retiring. And of course, the challenges that all industries are facing with finding skilled workers to perform the necessary work. Registered apprenticeship is unique in that the industries that it support are industries that cannot be outsourced. This is boots on the ground, hands on the hammer, or the electrical cords. And so it is very timely. We need to make an investment here. We need to support those community-based organizations that know better than we do about what those specific needs are and how to assist those community members in accessing a good workforce development program that will result in producing highly skilled workers that are capable of supporting their families. The next proposal that I'd like to talk about is the prevailing wage education and compliance. As I mentioned, Minnesota is on par to receive a substantial investment with the infrastructure projects that will be covered by prevailing wage law. The prevailing wage law exists in Minnesota to ensure projects funded with public money be constructed and maintained by the best means and the highest quality of labor reasonably available. And persons working on public work projects be compensated according to the real value of the services they propose, that they perform. A proposed base increase of $1.758 million each year would fully fund the current prevailing wage staff employed by the department, as well as additional staff necessary to provide education and enforcement to ensure our tax dollars are being used in the way that they were intended and not promoting exploitative practices such as wage theft. This proposal really, it's again, it too is twofold. One part of this, part of the proposal seek to address the long running underfunding of the prevailing wage program. Back in 2006, the state legislature gave the Department of Labor and Industry enforcement authority for prevailing wage. Prior to that, we acted more as a consultant. Even when complaints were filed and we performed a review of the projects in question, our only authority was to provide that feedback to the project owner, and it was entirely up to the project owner to enforce those prevailing wage provisions. The 2006 changes did a number of things. It gave labor and industry enforcement authority. It required project owners to specifically include prevailing wage rates in their bid documentation, and it created a minimum staffing level at the Department of Labor and Industry. It required that the department maintained a minimum of 3 investigatory staff for purposes of investigating prevailing wage complaints. A $150,000 appropriation was made at the time for the minimum staffing. the $150,000 that was appropriated, it did not even fully fund the three positions at that time. However, that was the amount that was determined that was needed to provide for the additional support staff. So the department has always had one or two prevailing wage investigators employed long before there was a specific appropriation for that. And so the $150,000 was to up staff to a minimum of three. Today, $150,000 only fully support one full-time position with a little change left over. This proposal would increase, would fully fund the existing staff, and it would add additional staffing to the prevailing wage unit. We are asking for 10 additional FTEs because we foresee that the investments that are being made in the infrastructure will be ongoing for many years to come. And because of the complexities of prevailing wage, we want to be prepared to provide as much outreach and education in order to educate new contractors that may be bidding on the projects, as well as continuing the education and outreach that is generally needed in the program. We believe that educating our stakeholders is the best way to encourage compliance. But when education and outreach does not work, it is important that regulators such as the Labor Standards Division Prevailing Wage Unit can help to right the wrong when contractors do not pay the correct wage rate or do not pay prevailing wage at all. So this is the second of the workforce investments, and we're hoping that you will support the proposal. The third proposal that I will speak to today is our youth skills training program. This is a program that is well received across the state and is utilized by developing partnerships among school districts, employers, and community-based organizations. It helps to provide meaningful work opportunities to 16 and 17-year-olds. We focus on industries that have a high growth and high growth and high demand, not just for today, but tomorrow as well. This is a fairly new program, so it is still, I would characterize it as still growing in terms of ensuring that all Minnesotans are aware of it. The program started back in 2017 and have had positive results from all users and participants. This proposal is asking for an additional $500,000 per year, which will provide grant funding to an estimated five additional youth skill training partnerships. Current grant funding is sufficient to support the 10 partnerships. However, in order to grow the program, additional resources are needed. With that, those are my prepared comments for those three initiatives. I'm certainly open to discussing any other portion of our budget bill But I think these two programs, these three initiatives bear additional discussion, and I'm happy to answer any questions or concerns. I also have, as I indicated, we have members of my team with me that can address not just the discussion today, but the discussion from last week as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. I guess we'll open it up for member questions for you, and then we'll continue on with testimony. First on the list that I had here is Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair. My question is for the Commissioner. Commissioner, you just talked about a lot of proposals and a lot of money. And I'm just wondering what the total FTEs are for all of these proposals. And if you could kind of break that down by divisions, I would appreciate that also.
Sure. All
right. Commissioner Robertson?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Oh, did you get that? Oh, sorry. Continue.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Chair, okay. If we're just talking about the proposals that I spoke with, we're talking about 10 FTEs for the prevailing wage program and for the equity in apprenticeship, that adds three positions.
All right, Representative Poston?
Okay. And I believe the YST program, I believe we are asking for one additional proposal there, but if you give me a second, I will confirm. The proposal for YST at 1.5 FTEs.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Poston?
Yep. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Next on the list is Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Robertson, on your earned sick and safe, you had a line item number of $1.367 million. What does that cover?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, earned sick and safe time. I might need some help from my staff. Christy, can you weigh in, please?
Christy?
Swanson.
Christy,
yes,
Swanson.
Thank you. Okay. Hi, my name is Christy Swanson. I'm the CFO at DLI. Sorry, my video does not work today. So for Earn Sick and Safe, the $1.367 million in the first year is supports the 10.8 FTE. That would be added to the Labor Standards Division to educate outreach on the new rules and requirements, and then in the outer years do enforcement and support to the employers.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Swanson. Representative Bliss?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's in addition to the number of employees that you just answered, Representative Poston. So I believe that was 10, one and a half, was it two,
three.
I think, and this is three, and now we're at 10.8 on this one. Holy cow, Minnesota's government is big enough. We don't need another 30 employees in this department. Let me ask you a question, Commissioner Robertson. The addition of 10 employees, is the department not staffed right now to do its job? How have we maintained over the past, let's just go 2 years, if you're 10 full-time staff in one department short, 10.8 in another department short, how are you continuing to function right now?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bliss, the proposals here The earned sick and safe time, that is a new proposal. So we've not been performing this function before. For the prevailing wage unit, for the prevailing wage initiative, we currently have three staff performing prevailing wage investigatory work. With the increase, with the pending increase of infrastructure dollars, we expect that there will be additional work that will be covered by prevailing wage, substantially more work in the very near future. And therefore, we are currently underfunded for the three positions that we do maintain. So part of the appropriation from the labor standards program is used to support prevailing wage enforcement. The additional positions would staff up the program for the new work that we expect that will come to Minnesota.
So you're currently staffed and functioning as we speak. You anticipate a workload increase of something that has not come forward yet. So you want more money. Let me, I understand, you know, you want to grow the government, and that's understandable, I guess. The $1.367 million, have you done an estimate of how much this is going to cost our job providers, employers out there?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Glist, I don't believe we've done that analysis, but with any proposal, we're required to produce a fiscal note, and we did evaluate what the expected cost of the program would result in.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've anticipated and calculated the growth of government, but didn't calculate the cost to our employers. And I have to just, this really sits bad with me right now, you know, especially since we just passed the deadline of the unemployment insurance increases to our employers. Then you're coming through with something like this and just crushing them. It just, the timing of this, the tone deafness of this proposal infuriates me. So if we were voting on this, Mr. Chair, I would be voting a no, but I understand it's going to be held over. So I think you have my thoughts. Thank you.
All right. Next on the list is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Eklund, for bringing this bill. I have two questions, actually. One about prevailing wage enforcement. And just, I know that as we expect to get a huge influx of resources to do the much needed infrastructure investments that we're going to do, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what it will mean if we don't have enough enforcement of that prevailing wage provision, what that might mean for workers.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, yes. As I indicated, prevailing wage has been around since, 1973 or so. And we know because we didn't always have enforcement authority. And at that time, when we did not have enforcement authority, it was really left to project owners, the individual state agencies, to oversee the enforcement of prevailing wage. I believe the risk that we run if we do not properly staff the unit, then we will not be able to investigate complaints. And it would encourage non-compliance when those contractors are bidding on state-funded projects. It would encourage non-compliance, which result in the individuals performing the work not getting the wage rate that is due to them based on the statutes.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, Chair Eklund, did you have more testifiers on the list?
We have a few more testifiers, Mr. Chair, but I think we if we can go quickly through these questions. I know Representative, there's a couple more people up, but yes. If we go quickly through these questions, we should be able to get to them. So
okay, all right. I just want to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to testify today. Representative Greenman, did you have another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just I appreciate that answer because I think what's important when we're talking about this is that we are ensuring that workers get the wages that they are due. When we have good employers who are doing it, that's not what we're concerned about here. What we're concerned about is ensuring that workers make that prevailing wage that they're entitled to. And so I think it's our obligation to make sure, especially as we're gonna see a more publicly funded projects, to ensure that the workers of Minnesota have access to that. So I really appreciate that, and I will save the rest of my questions for when we get to the testifiers. Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. And,
thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative McDonald, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Commissioner Robertson. Regarding the additional 10 full-time employees, now you said that's needed for the prevailing wage training compliance, if I didn't mistaken you for that. But is that based upon the $6 billion that you anticipate getting from the federal government for the Build Back Better bill? Is that correct, Commissioner?
Commissioner Robertson?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, like many of our proposals, these proposals are multi-pronged. So the 10 positions, the 10 FTEs is to ensure that we shore up the program in anticipation of federal infrastructure dollars coming into the state. So that part is correct. But the program itself, the prevailing wage program that is being administered today, relies on resources that are appropriated for the labor standards unit to help support the minimum staffing that is required in current law.
All right, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I will be quick with my answers and my comment. Commissioner, regarding the $500,000 for the youth programs and the apprentice, which targets 16-year-olds, my impression and observation, being in business for 35 years, and active in the community, various organizations, and then being in the legislature for 11 years, we are starting way too late on that at 16 years old. So A, we should double the money, that's another issue. And B, we should be starting in middle school, training and teaching kids good skilled labor if we wanted them to be in the pipeline. So frankly, it's almost too late, a dollar too late, dollar too soon, I guess, to get for that money. What's your thoughts on that regarding at 16 years old, when at that point, a lot of them have already geared towards college and or the military?
Commissioner Robertson?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, my thoughts around this are diverse. And for a couple of reasons. We know that we have to provide young people as early as possible with career information. However, there are currently, under most circumstances, individuals younger than 16 are only permitted to work in a very limited capacity. And so targeting a workforce program, starting it at 16, I think that is the right age to start the program where individuals are actually performing work. However, I agree with you that we should be doing more to expose all youth about career opportunities as early as possible. We know that middle school curriculums are starting to include career exploration. However, I think 16-year-olds, that is the right age to begin the work. In some of the work capacities in the youth skill training program, we work very closely with those employers to ensure that these are the job duties are safe enough for those minors to perform. And so considering a minor's need to stay in school, continue learning, and to stay safe, I think it is the right combination here. In this program especially, we have the ongoing support and participation of school districts, employers in the community, and community-based organizations. I agree with you. We should be looking for ways to expand the program.
Representative McNaughton.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you. Yes, well, that's something that maybe Representative Eklund and the crew we can work on for next year as well, or maybe later part of this year. But typical government, we're too late and spent too much in the program and we're too late. Remember, we had laws that didn't allow a 16-year-old to mow lawns. We had to change that law. So we don't do everything so perfect. And I think this is another area that we need to work on. And if we want to really get people, train them for a good skilled labor and get them in the pipeline in the trades. Personally, I hold the governor responsible for the supplemental bill. It's another indication it spends weeks our job creators, clearly. Double fines for OSHA fines, the paid and sick family leave time, which is a huge tax increase on businesses at a time that we're seeing 40-year inflation and gas prices, the highest we've ever seen in this nation. This has to stop. I don't hold you responsible, of course, Commissioner. You're just the messenger. It's the governor's bill, and it's not good for job creators. The priority should be getting the unemployment insurance passed because the bills have already gone out on job creators. They're going to be having to pay these bills and tax increases. And yet with this bill, if this becomes legislation, well, thanks be to God it's not, because it's not going anywhere in the Senate, it's yet another tax hike and increase and extra penalties and regulations on businesses. And for that reason, Commissioner and Representative Chair Eklund, although you're not asking for a vote, I can't support this. It's not good for Minnesota. It's not good for the job creators. More money, more government, more spending, and hard on our job creators. That's all I have to say on my soapbox today, Mr. Chair.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd actually like to save my question until after all the testifiers have gone.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Berg. Chair Eklund, you have any the next testifier? Is it Mr. Thorson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm legislative director of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, energy infrastructure, and the basic utilities that allow our communities to thrive. I'm here today to support House File 4177, the governor's supplemental budget for DLI, and we'll speak to three provisions in particular. First, we support increased staffing to provide additional prevailing wage education, compliance, and enforcement to help assure people working on construction projects supported with tax dollars are compensated with a family supporting wage and benefits package. Increasing DLI's capacity in this area is especially important and timely as Minnesota will be receiving an influx of up to $6 billion in federal funding for critical transportation and water infrastructure projects over the next several years. Increased enforcement of prevailing wage is a critical issue for both my organization and all of the state building and construction trades unions. Next, we support increasing DLI's capacity to administer, grow, and provide support to Minnesota's registered apprenticeship programs. Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota operates the state's largest and most diverse skilled construction registered apprenticeship program. We partner with nearly 900 contractors to provide 150,000 training hours a year that continuously upskill and expands Minnesota's construction workforce in order to meet market needs. In fact, we've recently doubled the size and increased the capacity of our training center. And registered apprenticeship programs like ours are engines of economic inclusion that launch women, people of color, veterans, and other underrepresented groups not fully participating in the economy into lifelong construction careers. And finally, I want to express our support for conforming MnOSHA penalties with federal standards and allow our state system to issue higher maximum penalties when it's determined that workers are subject to unsafe or unhealthy workplace conditions. Job site safety is a high priority for LIUNA and all the construction trades unions, and this is a policy change that is long overdue. Mr. Chair, I want to thank the governor and lieutenant governor for proposing these items in a supplemental budget, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to them today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. Next up, we have Melissa Heising.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Melissa Heising, and I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state's labor federation of more than 1,000 local unions who represent more than 300,000 working people throughout our state. I'm here to highlight our strong support of several items in the governor's budget. Ensuring workplace safety for all Minnesotans is always one of our top priorities. According to the AFL-CIO's most recent annual report on the state of safety and health protection for America's workers, the national average penalty for a serious OSHA violation was $2,973. Minnesota's average penalty was less than half of that at $1,114, and Minnesota had the third lowest average penalty of any state in the country. Minnesota OSHA penalties have not been adjusted in over 20 years. As a state plan, we must be, at least as effective as federal OSHA to maintain our state program. Conforming to federal law will ensure that we maintain our state program and federal funding, as well as deter workplace health and safety violations by employers. That is why we support raising Minnesota's OSHA penalties to conform to federal law and indexing future penalties to inflation. We also support the increase in funding for prevailing wage, education, and compliance, especially with massive federal funding for infrastructure coming to our state. It is important to ensure that funding creates jobs with family-sustaining wages, and increasing enforcement of prevailing wage will help to do that. In the wake of a global pandemic, it has become clearer than ever that all working Minnesotans need to be able to take paid time off when they are sick, both to take care of themselves and to avoid spreading disease, and as well as longer-term leave to deal with a serious illness or to bond with a new child. Too many Minnesotans are forced to choose between going to work sick and not being able to pay their bills or worrying about getting fired. Earned sick and safe time and paid family and medical leave will enable Minnesotans to take care of themselves and their families. Finally, bonuses for frontline workers are long overdue. Whether they were caring for COVID patients, stocking grocery shelves, caring for children, driving buses, or processing meat, anyone who could not work from home risked their own health and the health of their families by going to work. Department of Health data on workplace outbreaks shows that anyone who worked in close proximity with people outside their household was at increased risk of exposure to COVID-19. In addition to the risk that they faced, these workers were forced to quarantine, often without pay, often multiple times, over the past 2 years. While a $1,500 payment won't make these workers whole for what they have been through, it is critical to recognize the sacrifices they made to take care of us and keep our state running during the pandemic, and to honor our commitment and agreement to provide those bonuses to those workers. Thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you, Ms. Heising. Next we have Sherry Hansen. Please introduce yourself and you may proceed. Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee, and Commissioner. My name is Sherry Hansen, and I'm the Director of Advocacy for the American Institute of Architects, Minnesota, which represents more than 2,200 architecture and design professionals in our state. I'm here today to offer our support for amending the energy code adoption timelines in the statutes as outlined in this bill. AIA Minnesota and its member architects are committed to addressing the significant impact the built environment has on our climate. The built environment accounts for as much as 40% of carbon emissions and energy use. Making changes here could be the next big impact opportunity to make our state more energy efficient and energy independent. We are also experiencing a greater frequency of extreme weather events, which is already increasing costs and financial risks for all Minnesotans, farmers, building owners, local governments, and residents. Setting specific energy efficiency targets like those in this proposal will help designers, developers, and building owners chart a course for a net zero future, something we desperately need. Accelerating the state adaptation and adoption of the most current energy code ensures that every community, developer, architect, and tradesperson is on a low playing field, because better, healthier buildings shouldn't just be for some. They should be for all, and the building code is an important tool we can use to attain equitable access. The proposed standard would still go through the rigorous Minnesota code adoption process, where Minnesota-specific changes are made and all stakeholders across the design and construction industry are consulted. We need to begin to address the very real impacts of the built environment on our changing climate, and these provisions will help us do that. We urge you to move this forward and adopt it this session. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. And then next we have Brian Stefanich.
Yep, good job. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members, and commissioner. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony on behalf of the U Skills Training Program. My name is Brian Stefanich, and you did a really good job pronouncing my name, by the way. I'm the director of the Bemidji Career Academy program at Bemidji High School. I'm happy to be here today to speak in support of funding increase proposed by the Department of Labor and Industry for U Skills Training Program and House File 4177. As a YST grant recipient the past 2 years, I can speak firsthand to the benefits the program has had for our community. The Bemidji Career Academy program at Bemidji High School is a self-funded program, and we're in our fifth year. The mission of our academies is to create learning opportunities for business and community industry partners to collaborate and prepare the next generation of employees and community leaders. Our goal is to train our students and retain our talent to our community. We rely on local foundation grants to fund our academy team of 1.75 FTE staff, including myself, the director, counselor, and a secretary, which are part-time, as well as a host of other grants and business and industry sponsorships to defray all costs for our students. The U Skills Training Program gave us the opportunity to expand our 16 and 17-year-old student opportunities to explore careers in high-growth, high-demand occupations by providing unique and rewarding paid internships. By waiving numerous child labor laws, especially in the automotive technology, it helped get our students on the floor in service stations. In the past 15 months, we have placed 24 16 and 17-year-old students in 27 YST paid internships and 12 approved YST internship programs. I'm placing another 3 students at the end of this week as well. Our partners have commented that our interns are welcomed by all staff and bring a needed youthful energy to their work sites. Our interns are being mentored by skilled staff, and long-lasting relationships are being formed. Bemidji Steel Company's last 8 hires have been our academy students. They actually have a second shift after school for our students. The grant dollars have helped us pay for student credentials in our nursing assistant courses, 28 students this year, and in our manufacturing mechatronics courses at the Minnesota Innovation Initiative, we've had 7 students earn 15 credentials in 5 mechatronics or manufacturing classes. The YST dollars help us in marketing our program, including the fees associated with our Bemidji Career Academy website. We also take our students on a lot of field trips, gaining valuable industry exposure with the transportation funding. In conclusion, I support the YST funding increase in this bill, as it will enable funding for additional partners across our state and prepare more young people in the workforce for high growth, high demand, livable wage occupations. Lastly, I just want to put a shout out to Rich Wessels. He's the program director. He is outstanding in his position, and it's a true pleasure to work with him. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stefanich. Next, we have Barbara Doyle. Please state your name, and you may begin your testimony.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members, and also Commissioner. I really appreciate this opportunity to testify today. Again, my name is Dr. Barbara Doyle. I'm Director of Workforce Solutions at the Urban League Twin Cities. As you know, it was formerly the Minneapolis Urban League. So I am happy to be here today to speak in support of the funding increase proposed by the LEAP program in House File 4177. So I too can speak firsthand to the benefits this program has had for our community. But I'd like to say that for more than 90 years, Minnesotans have looked to the Urban League Twin Cities as a source of strength in the community, from employment to education to engagement. Urban League seeks to help people of color, women, and indigenous people in training and employment programs. Strive for and achieve economic empowerment and self-sufficiency to build wealth that can be passed down from generation to generation. So why the LEAP program is so important? The Urban League Twin Cities has had a long history of contracts through the LEAP program. And to echo Commissioner Robertson's comments, funding has significantly decreased over the years. I started at the Urban League in 2016, and I looked at the data, and from 2016 to 2021, 56 participants completed pre-apprenticeship programs and were hired by contractors and sponsored into union trades and placed in level of jobs at an average salary earning close to $20 an hour. This depending on the trade. So while we were able to help change lives of these 56 people and help them with career pathway opportunities and earn livable wages through the LEAP program, I feel this is a small number that Urban League could only serve over these past 6 years, as our capacity to serve them was based on the amount of funding we received. So I did the math, so we're talking about only 8 or 9 per year that we were able to enroll into the program. So we know the demand is there and people consistently come to the Urban League needing our services, and the number of requests continues to increase. However, we need more solutions to the table and funding to address this issue. So expanding funding helps organizations to increase capacity and the community could benefit. However, limited funding prevents us from providing innovative wraparound services, providing needed support services to participants, such as the tools that they need, the work clothing, gas cards, helping with skills training, and some may need minor car repairs to make sure that they are able to travel to work sites. Those are just to name a few. So as we are coming out of the pandemic, we need to recognize that more people are eager to get back to work, and we need to be able to respond to the target population needing our services. Also, increased funding will help address the needs of the number of people in our primary service area, the majority of them being people of color, and specifically African Americans. So in closing, we envision a future in which African descendants, women, indigenous people can be fully engaged, empowered, and invested in the success and well-being of the Twin Cities metro area. So in closing, we believe that a strong and systemic change is needed to transform our communities. However, the lack of funding continues to be a major issue affecting our ability to provide a quality and more effective service to the number of people requesting participation into the LEAD program. So thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. And are there any other testifiers wishing to testify? All right, and we will open up to member questions. Representative Berg, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank all the testifiers for the really important points that they made and the information they've shared with us. And to that end, I'd like to build upon something that Ms. Heising brought up that is also on the governor's agenda, and that is the frontline worker pay. I know that that is not specifically in this particular bill, but it is our shared values. And as we're looking at all the different pieces of this presentation, I was wondering if the commissioner could talk a little bit about frontline worker pay.
All right, Commissioner Robertson.
Mr. Chair, yes. Took a moment for the screen to open. Yes, I'd be happy to talk about the frontline worker group pay. I participated on the frontline worker work group this past summer. We had engaging, informative discussions. And what came out of that was that, yes, we were all impacted by COVID. However, there are groups of workers that were more impacted because they did not have the opportunity to work from home. They did not have an opportunity to collect unemployment with top-offs between $600 and $300. And so the governor remains committed to recognizing these essential workers. We've talked about different definitions of frontline versus essential. The reality is without the essential workers like daycare workers, grocery store workers, meatpacking workers, transportation workers, many of the individuals who are considered frontline workers, those that provided direct care to COVID patients, those individuals would not have been able to do their job. So the governor has taken a more holistic approach at looking at who those critical workers are and have recommended $1 billion to provide some type of financial recognition. We agree that $1,500 will not make these individuals whole. However, it is a small token to demonstrate that we are in fact appreciative of the sacrifices and that they made and the risks that they took, particularly at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. Since the work group, labor and industry have continued to work with the Department of Revenue and DEED to come up with some type of framework that will allow us to quickly implement legislation once it is agreed upon and signed by the governor. We're prepared and we're ready, but the proposed $1 billion is targeted to 667,000 workers that would apply for the benefit, and labor and industry would do the preliminary screening, and DEED and revenue will do the verification based on whether or not the individuals received unemployment, and revenue will provide verification for the agreed up on income level. We continue to work hard. We're meeting on this subject every day. We encourage this legislation to be passed by legislators. So we appreciate your support. And if there are any other specific questions you have, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Commissioner. I really appreciate that. As a frontline worker who was exposed as a flight attendant, had to quarantine a few times, had COVID, I really appreciate the measures that we're taking for our frontline workers. And I would just like this committee, but also all of our colleagues, to keep this front of mind. It's incredibly important to see the humanity in the folks that were most at risk, but continued to take care of all of us. So thank you for your answer, Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this one brief. Just so everybody knows, I'm not always a negative person. I do want to recognize Mr. Stefanich's program up there in Bemidji. That is one amazing program. I've seen personally firsthand the difference it makes in these kids. It is an amazing program, and I second Representative McDonald's suggestion that we increase the funding to this program. This is an amazing program and does wonders for our kids. So there you go. There's my positive thought for the day.
Thank you, Representative Blues. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is kind of geared towards the commissioner here. I do a lot of work in the vulnerable adult space, and I was curious on what the implications would be if DLI did not have jurisdiction over assisted living facilities.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick, I would really appreciate if one of my staff could address this concern. We have Scott McCowan on the line.
Mr. McCowan?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, could you repeat the question? It kind of cut out at the end. I caught part of the assisted living, and then something, the last part of the question kind of faded out. So if you wouldn't mind just restating the question, I'd appreciate that.
Representative Frederick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is, if DLI does not have jurisdiction over assisted living facilities, what would be some of the consequences of that?
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. McCall?
Thank you, Representative. The ramifications are, right now, the Department of Labor Industry has code oversight over all licensed facilities that are licensed by other state agencies. And as many of you may be aware, that the building code is not adopted throughout the whole entire state of Minnesota. So in non-code areas, there would be no code oversight. So there would be no regulation of the construction of those buildings. So it would be similar to a licensed facility now, like a nursing home or a hospital, where the health department licenses the facilities. They do some compliance plan reviews and checks things to NFPA 101, which is a different construction standard. So without providing code oversight, there would be no ability to verify co-compliance for vulnerable adults that are living in these facilities. So we would like to have the authority to do code administration, plan review, and inspections on these facilities, just like we do currently for nursing homes and hospitals.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the answer. I think that makes a pretty clear point, too, that we need to make sure that we're taking care and protecting Minnesotans across the state. And in order to do that, state agencies need to have appropriate staffing levels, because I sure would hate for an argument to be out there that we're just not staffed well enough to do a job, so they're not doing a good job. So I want to make sure that we are putting our values and our money forward to make sure that we are supporting Minnesotans across the state and making sure that DLI has the appropriate level of staff that they need. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Frederick. Representative Bliss, did you have another question or comment?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I'll put my hand down.
Okay. All right. Any other questions or comments from members? Chair Eklund, any final comments for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few, as you probably expected. But first off, members, this is the Labor Committee. We take care of labor issues, not business issues. We have other committees that take care of that. We are focused on taking care of our laborers, veterans, and military affairs folks. Prevailing wage is a necessary and vital aspect for protecting our workforce and for making sure that we have high quality jobs done when we use public money to build them. And I applaud the commissioner for asking for the FTEs to make sure that this happens. The infrastructure bill that recently passed Congress has got, about $6 billion or so coming to the state of Minnesota. We need good prevailing wage and wage theft practices in place to make sure the money is spent properly. Nobody asked the commissioner about Minnesota OSHA and compliance. I think our GOP members might be surprised, and they haven't come right out and told me, because Minnesota Chamber doesn't necessarily agree with the positions that as chair I've taken in this committee. But if we don't comply with federal OSHA and they take our OSHA compliance away from Minnesota OSHA, then it'll just become automatic fines. And I think Ms. Heising hit it just perfectly. Minnesota is one of the lowest states for fining because the Department of Labor and Industry has done a terrific job of working with industry and trying to fix the problem rather than immediately assessing the maximum fine that they have available. So I think Department of Labor and Industry should be applauded for that. And we do need to, if we conform federally, they can still keep practicing that. 16-year-olds on jobs, this training. Mr. Stefanich, thank you for your testimony. By the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that Rachel Omdahl is a very good friend of mine. So I know that she works with you down there. We need to figure out how to get our youth involved in the trades and other type things. And this is a terrific program to do it. And I applaud the governor and the agency for bringing this forward. And, you know, this probably belongs in the Commerce Department too, but gas prices were mentioned by one of my colleagues. We have no purview over gas prices in the Department of Labor or in the Labor and Industry, Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. And I remember 2008 when I was working on campaigns, we were paying higher gas prices in 2008 than we were right now. It's a product of the world market. And if you guys might want to know that I tweeted out an article about our good friends to the west in North Dakota have not increased, the companies have not increased the production, and they have the capability to do it. So it's a world problem. It's not something that the governor has created with his budget here for the Department of Labor and Industry. Overall, Mr. Chair and members, I think this is a terrific bill. I think, and you will get a chance to vote on it. We're laying it over right now because we'll probably be adding a few more things. So with that, Mr. Chair, I ask for your support.
All right. Chair Eklund renews his motion that House File 4177 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Any further questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none, our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 22nd, 2022. We will be reviewing budget proposals from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and Department of Military Affairs. And with that, we are adjourned.